Welcome, Jane. It's so great to have you with me today.
It's terrific to be here. Thanks.
So, in this challenging economy, people are still traveling. How have itineraries changed?
Well, I think a lot of people are looking to do things that obviously are going to be a little closer to home, providing they're traveling with a group of people, though there are a lot of airfare sales on. So if you're traveling as a couple, people are still able to go pretty far afield. But primarily, it's a little bit shorter and a little bit closer to home.
Well, talking about airfare, it seems to me just casually that the airfares are going up, up, and away. So where do you look for these, you know, more affordable airfares?
Well, here's the secret. Airfares are going up and up, but all of the airlines are constantly doing these 24-hour flash sales. And so if there's an airline that you fly regularly, for instance, since I live in Miami, I'm often on American Airlines because they're a primary carrier here. I sign up for their alerts on fare sales. And you can also sign up for a service called smartertravel.com. And one of the great things about Smarter Travel is that they send you an email every week with different deals from your specific market. So that also helps you keep tab.
Oh, okay. That was smartertravel.com, right?
Smartertravel.com.
Okay.
And I'll give you an example. One of the things that I found is yesterday I was looking at airfares and thinking, oh, this is more than I want to pay. And then within 12 hours, I got an alert on my phone. It was actually from the airline specific that I'd signed up with. And it told me that they had a fare sale on. And lo and behold, I was able to get that fare for $100 cheaper.
Wow. Can you give us an insider's look at some places that you're writing about that are on the cusp of being discovered but are still relatively unspoiled?
Well, that's always a tough go. And there are a lot of places far afield that are sort of relatively undiscovered. So we always think about places in Latin America that haven't gotten huge mobs yet, or some places in Eastern Europe, particularly Croatia's become pretty popular, but some of the places that are a bit north of there have become, you know, not as well known. Bosnia in particular is becoming sort of a new place to go that isn't well discovered. But I would say that here in the U.S. there are also a lot of places that maybe people don't know about, or experiences that people don't know about, that really are relatively affordable. And because they're not on your radar screen, you maybe don't think of going there, or you think it's something other than what it was or is today. So there are places closer to home worth discovering as well.
All right. So, okay, you walk into a bookstore, you go to the shelf, there's Frommer's, Fodor, Lonely Planet, Eyewitness. How do you choose? And are some books geared more towards youth travel, budget travel? Where do you start?
Okay. One of the places that I think is always worth starting is a new category that's come up a bit in the last few years, and it's sort of, they call it travel. They still call them travel guides, but they're not really. They're books that are survey experiences. So you will find, for instance, one that I just was involved in writing, the 100 Best Affordable Vacations from National Geographic, but it's certainly not the only book in this category. You'll find a lot of things, the 100 Best Trips, the 100 Best This. Everybody's heard of, you know, places to see before you die. And those are good surveys that might help you think about some places you didn't know about. Beyond that, when it goes to specific guides, I have personal opinions, having used most of them over the time. Most people think of Lonely Planet as being a guidebook series for younger or backpack travelers. And while that is still true, in recent years, Lonely Planet has made a real effort to include the more up-end and mid-range options for people who, okay, I'm a little beyond the backpacking thing myself. So Lonely Planet is a better guidebook, a more wide-ranging guidebook, I think, than it used to be. I like both Fodor's and Frommer's, but I think you've got to look at each book because each one's written by a different author. So you want to kind of look at the author in the front. I have to tell you that many people love the eyewitness guides, but I tried to use one recently on a trip, and one of the things that I was reminded of is that while they have great graphics, they're really not deep on information. And so when I wanted more historical background about, I happened to be in India, it just didn't give me as much as I wanted. So I think from a graphic standpoint, they're very appealing, but if you're one of those people like I am who want a little background on the place, probably doesn't work as well for you.
All right. In your book, The 100 Best Affordable Vacations, talk a little bit about learning vacations, because I think that's certainly a rising category, and I think people may not know where to go to find out about these.
Well, learning vacations have been pretty much all the rage in the last couple of years, and there are a variety of different kinds of learning vacations. There are ones that are put out by the company that used to be called Elder Hostel, and that doesn't mean you have to be ancient to qualify, but that in fact it's pretty much the AARP range, which I think is now, isn't 60 the new 40? So it's 50 and over, and it's called Rhodes Scholar, and they have a lot of different kinds of learning vacations. But beyond that, there are other places that do as well. Many universities offer summer courses. Some of them are short and some of them are long, that are geared toward, you know, learning a new skill. They're also, one of the things I was just entranced by and sort of put on my own bucket list is a number of craft schools around the country that you can go and learn to make paper beads, or you can go and learn to make brooms. There are a lot of different kinds of scenarios there. There's one that's a wooden boat school, and I have to confess that this had not been something that hit my own radar screen, but my husband went to it with a buddy, and they just thought that this was a great experience. So there's a kind of learning vacation for whoever you are in your specific niche, and they are surprisingly affordable. I thought these things would be, you know, bank breakers, but they're really not.
All right. Well, in addition to TripAdvisor, which online user-generated content sites do you like and do you trust?
Well, TripAdvisor is a plus-minus scenario, as you may know. On the one hand, it has a lot of different reviews, and that's always a good thing, but those reviews are not pre-vetted. They are not necessarily written by people who've actually stayed in the place they're writing about. So sometimes you do get the, you know, sister-in-law effect, even though they try very hard not to let that happen, or the disgruntled, cranky person who gets all their friends to write. And my advice on TripAdvisor itself is, if it has a lot of different reviews on a property, that makes it more trustworthy, because you're going to have, you know, 500 people weighing in.
Yeah.
But if there are only a handful of reviews, I'm a bit more cautious. For that reason, I tend to go toward the reviews that are on hotels.com and other booking sites like that. And the reason is that in order to post a review on any of those sites, you must have actually booked and stayed in the hotel through that company. So hotels.com, someplace like Expedia and Travelocity, any of those sites require you to have actually booked through them to then post a review. And I'm more comfortable with that, and I think that the trustworthy factor with that is higher. But again, it's always worth bearing in mind that people who post reviews are often people who did not like something. And you always need to take that with a grain of salt.
That's really good advice. All right, let's say that you're on vacation and you're in a, you know, you're in one of the cities. What apps do you like for advice? I mean, I use Yelp when I'm traveling in the U.S. and so on, but are there others that, okay, you're in San Francisco and you want the best Asian restaurant? I mean, what do you recommend?
Well, I think, again, the sites that have widespread acceptance, like Yelp, are good places to go. TripAdvisor is a good place to go. Zagat's is a good place to go. But beyond that, increasingly what you're seeing is more and more guidebooks come out on apps. And some of them are app-only, some of them are in print. But there are, you know, for $1.99, you can take a look and see what somebody who's a professional journalist, who, if they've done their job well, have looked at a lot of different restaurants, a lot of different hotels, and have gone and out, actually gone out and experienced those things. And those are good places to look. Sutro Media publishes a lot of those. You wouldn't probably know it's called Sutro Media, but you could go and look there and see what apps are out there. But I think it's the same, you know, in terms of user reviews, it's the same sites that you're accustomed to using on a computer, on a tablet, you're also going to be using them on a smartphone.
Oh, all right. Now, in your book, you give some tips about how to be a traveler and not a tourist. Can you share some of those?
Well, sure. I think we've all been tourists, no question about it, and it's not a bad thing either. But being a tourist means you probably have gone and looked at something. You walk in the door of the museum, you stare at the painting on the wall, and don't get me wrong, I'm a big museum fan, but you go in and you just kind of look at things, you don't partake. And one of the ways you become more of a traveler, one of it is just taking time to wander around a place, to go to the places local people go, and in fact, talk to local people. So you want to go to the best pie shop in the town and just chat up the people. You can get engaged by doing something like a rebuilding together project, something that puts you a little bit closer in touch with the place itself. But my number one piece of advice, and I think anybody who has done a lot of traveling, is to get off the beaten path and take time. Don't be so overscheduled that all you have time to be is a tourist. To be a traveler, you need just a little bit more time, and that doesn't mean you have to take an extra week. My co-author on the book, Larry Blyberg, used to have a rule that when he was traveling on business, he would schedule in an afternoon where he literally put on his schedule, just get lost. And by doing that, he would go and wander, and I've done the same thing, and you end up in that little local whatever it is, or you ask for the recommendation of the local person, and you end up someplace you never knew you were going to go, and it gives you a real sense of the people of a place, because that's what places are. They're really about the people.
So when you're scheduling or kind of planning out your, for example, European itinerary, mm-hmm. when you're talking about a major capital, how many days should you really devote? I mean, and what's your opinion on that?
Well, I would say that many places sort of add up to me like this. They're either good for 3 days or they're good for 3 months. And what happens for me is that you can do the surface of a place rather quickly. And if that's what you've got to give that place, I would say a minimum of 3 days. But there's some places that after 3 days, you really sort of wear out on them unless you've got a lot more time to give them. I think any European capital, you know, you can easily spend a week if you consider that part of what you're going to be doing with that time is wandering, is sitting in the patisserie, and is taking day trips out of that capital so that you've got some extra time. But it also depends on who you're traveling with. If you're traveling with kids who are going to need to, you know, take an afternoon break, if you're traveling with an older adult who's going to need an afternoon nap, or even I might need an afternoon nap because I'm jet lagged, then you add a couple of extra days. But I think 3 days is the absolute minimum. Even places I've gone to, and there are places I've gone to dozens and dozens of times, I still don't give it less than 3 days.
Hmm. All right. Now, here's a question I want to ask as a parent of college-age kids. Back in the day, it was Europe on $5 and $10 a day. If you're sending your kid off for a summer vacation in Europe and they're backpacking and they've already purchased their EuroRail pass, how much should they budget? And they're doing hostels, let's say that, or, you know, reasonable lodgings. How much should they go in there with it? For a daily, you know, budget, what should they have in their pockets?
Well, I think they're going to have to, it depends on where exactly they're going because the exchange rates are a big issue.
Yeah.
But I think you are going to need to have a minimum of $50 a day in your pocket. If you're talking about food, lodging, you've already got that EuroRail pass, but if you're going to go to a museum, although I have to say that museums and many attractions have free or student prices in Europe, and one of the things you should really do if you're a student traveling is make sure you have a student ID because you can get free into a lot of places. You're still going to, though, want to buy, you know, some entries, some attractions, and I think 35 to 50 is going to be your absolute bare minimum.
All right. So, okay, I know that your book is available through the National Geographic website, but where else can we find it?
You can find it in many local bookstores, wherever local is for you, and they definitely have it on Amazon, and they do have it on Kindle.
Oh, all right. Well, thank you so much, Jane. Your book is really valuable tool, and I think before you head off on your summer vacation, you might want to check it out. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you. You have a great day.
All right. Bye.
Bye.